Hello, fellow White Scarves. We all know you're fans of the MCU, so you've already heard of Maria Hill, the hyper-competent second of Nick Fury. But this woman stands head and shoulders above that, being the head of the NIA of New Century, as well as voicing one of the most puissant mages of the known universe. So welcome one and all to our interview with Maya the Mountain Santandrea. This is White Scarves Team Up. Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Through the Windor, where we are finally going to interview the most important person.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry, Loretta. I didn't mean that. You know you're my favorite. Please don't hit me with the cooking stick.
Okay, technically the most important person is Alex, and we've already had that conversation, and we're sure to have more of them later on. But I will admit that for all the fact that several of the other people that we have interviewed thus far have had a longer journey within New Century, I am the most fascinated for this particular person because of all of the work that she has done outside of New Century. Very pleased to introduce stunt actress extraordinaire and also maker of incredibly amazing voices, Maya Santandrea.
Hello, guys.
Hello.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm glad we finally got you in because you were one of the first people to respond back when all of this was going on. And I don't remember at the time if we knew, if anyone had mentioned that you were in the running to do the new voice of Merlane going forward. I definitely just, we had interacted a lot on Twitter and the Discord, and yes. I just thought you were generally a very cool person.
Thank you.
And I think that now, as mentioned on the Discord chat and elsewhere, I wanted to do this interview now. As always, we are very possibly going to have other people back on to discuss individual things as they come up. But this is one going to be the first interviews that's going to actually go up very soon because it topically connects itself to the regular episodes of Through the Windor that we are doing. Mm-hmm. So let's just jump right into it. Longtime fans of School of Movies are well acquainted with your voice by now, as you have brought insight into the inner workings of movies thanks to your long-term experience in Hollywood, as well as your own trademark humor and analysis. But we haven't necessarily heard as much about you as a person and your background, aside from brief snippets of media projects you have worked for. Mm. And we're very curious if you would mind giving us some of the firsts on a synopsis of the evolution of your work in the industry, how you came to specialize in being a stunt performer, and finally, how you first made contact with Alex to become a friend of the podcast.
Yes. These are all great questions, and I'm sure Alex is going to be kicking himself because he did not interview me before he got to you, before I got to you guys.
Got the premier interview.
Oh yeah, you guys got to me first. Although I'm sure he may actually do something with me at some point in the future, but he's been threatening to do it for a long time, and we've never actually gotten around to it. So congrats to you guys for jumping on it. Touché. So to answer your first question, to go into how I came to be in this absolutely crazy industry and how that kind of evolved. So I think I mentioned most recently in the Labyrinth show, which I actually commissioned, in which I normally wouldn't do this, but I insisted that I be on it because I had such a strong connection to that movie and I just loved it so much. I was like, I'm not commissioning this show without actually adding my own two cents. I have to. So I had mentioned in that recording that I've been acting pretty much since I was 12 years old. And before that, I would watch movies all the time. I always had a love of cinema. I always had a love of fantasy and science fiction. You know, I've been watching Indiana Jones and Star Wars and, the Mad Max movies and all kinds of, touchstones in the action and genre films, really. from a very young age, which for somebody who grew up in the 80s, I don't think is all that unusual, to be honest. I think a lot of people kind of around my age range would probably find themselves in a similar position where the shows and the films that they really remember growing up were like Star Trek, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, you know, the Alien movies, maybe to a lesser extent, some of the John Carpenter movies and things like that. And those were the things that I really took away, you know, from my childhood were some of these like action and genre movies that I watched when I was growing up. I used to, I have no idea where I get this from, but like, this was a consistent thing throughout my childhood. My sister and I would watch movies like this over and over again. We would memorize things like The Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Princess Bride, Spaceballs, you know, the gamut of all these different genre movies. And we would try to do the voices and we would try to quote them with each other. Like we could recite entire movies just by ourselves all the time. This was just something that we did. And as I got a little bit older, I found that there was a community theater, small community theater, just outside of the town where we were growing up. And the first production that I was in A Midsummer Night's Dream. And from that, it was like one of those things where it was a cool thing to do after school. It was an excuse to hang out with my friends and do something that wasn't related to our school or our parents or anything else. Like this was something for us that we really enjoyed and that we were very passionate about. And
what role did you play? Now I want to know.
I played one of the comedians that put on the fake play at the end of the show.
Ah, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I was one of the, I believe they call them mechanicals. I was one of them. And so, you know, everybody else was like a fairy and everything else. And they cast me in one of the comedy roles, of course. So, and we were very at home there, you know, it felt very familiar. It felt like this was just another way to do the voices and to do the comedy. And I get a little bit nervous when I'm in front of a live audience. I still do. But I really enjoyed it in spite of that fact. I was always kind of a shy kid when I was really, really young, and being on stage and performing in front of people kind of helped me come out of my shell a little bit, where I became much more outgoing. I was much more comfortable with myself and I wasn't so timid anymore. I wasn't afraid to talk to people anymore. So that was kind of a neat little side effect of that. But also, you know, my parents didn't mind because I was learning Shakespeare at the same time.
Very educational.
Exactly. My teachers loved it because they were like, oh, the four of you are getting like a jump start on learning this old English text. Like this is stuff you're going to have to study later in your high school year. So it's awesome that you're getting a jump on it now. So it made it easier for me to go into things like Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet years later, because I already knew how to read Shakespeare, basically. We'd already kind of gotten a crash course in that because we performed it. And because we saw so many other people doing it night after night in rehearsals. So that was kind of my crash course into acting. I did that for several years when I was in middle school and a little bit into high school, did some stuff at school, although we didn't necessarily have a theater department. Every once in a while, they would stage like a musical or something. So in my senior year, I was very, very happy and had a ton of fun voicing Audrey II for a production of Little Shop of Horrors that we did. It was so much fun. It was great.
Brilliant.
I may have to have you do that voice later on, but please continue.
If I can, oh God, that was so long ago. If I can remember how
it's
I did
in there. We know it's still in there.
I will do my best to recreate it, but it has been many, many years since that. So from there, I knew that I wanted to do something involving acting or something on the stage or something with film and television once I got through college. I'm double majored in English and theater. When I did my undergrad, I studied theater and film studies in my graduate school years, which was a 2-year program, which was enough for me because it was hard. it was a difficult couple of years. So once those were done and I had my MA in theater and film, I was kind of done at that point. But in the meantime, I had picked up some martial arts. I'd picked up a lot of stage combat. I'd worked with a lot of weapons and, you know, from doing Shakespeare and from doing some period pieces, you learn how to wield a sword. You learn how to handle a knife, that sort of thing. And you learn some stage punches and things like that, too. growing from that experience, I realized that that was what I was actually truly passionate about. I really liked doing the action parts. And of course, that tied back into my love of all of those action and genre films from my childhood. Like how cool would it be if I was the one throwing the punches, if I was the one jumping out of the building or sliding the car and, you know, all those other things? What if I was the person that was in the water and had to act underwater because the actor can't do it? You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, I did a bunch of training. I caught up with some people that were in the industry. It was a lot of networking and meeting certain people that kind of led me in a direction that sort of kind of became the start of my career. I was in New York at the time. This was back in 2010, 2011. A friend of mine who I had met through training and who lived in Atlanta mentioned that Georgia had a really good tax incentive program and that film and television production was kind of shifting in that direction. So by this point, New Orleans, Louisiana was kind of already in that state. Like they had already had a very, very competitive tax incentive program. Detroit was kind of there as well, but it, like, there was just a shift away from Hollywood, actually. There was a shift away from California to markets like New Mexico, Arizona, Chicago, Detroit, New Orleans, the North and South Carolina, Florida, and then finally to Georgia by the early 2010s. So that is how I found myself moving to Atlanta, because I had a few connections there. And I thought, if this is a relatively new industry in that state, I may have an easier time breaking into it than I would in New York. And it turned out to be absolutely true. Now, it wasn't easy, of course. There was still a lot of work, a lot of training, a lot of networking. But eventually, one of the friends that I had made in the industry decided to give me my first shot. And my very first production was actually a made-for-television Hallmark movie, and which is odd to say it that way, but that was where I first got my foot in the door. And then, you know, it was difficult. I was having a little bit of trouble transitioning into the different culture and the different lifestyle of Georgia. It's a lot slower than New York, which should surprise no one, but eventually I kind of got my footing. And once I was kind of in the union and was starting to establish myself and showing myself to be reliable and, you know, consistent in my work, the very next project I landed was The Walking Dead. And I finally got to do stunts on The Walking Dead, which had been in Georgia for a couple of years already. And then after that was a huge, huge break when I met Chad Stahelski, who many of the listeners may know as being one of the directors for the John Wick movies. He was coordinating the Hunger Games movies at the time. Hunger Games: Catching Fire was in Georgia. I met him. I had a really nice talk to him. And he was one of those coordinators that could have taken one look at my 2-credit resume and gone, get out of my office. Like, don't waste my friggin' time. But he took me seriously and actually said, you know what? You have a very specific look that we're looking for, and I definitely need locals for this production. If we can use you, I will definitely give you a call. And a few weeks later, he did. And that was kind of the start to booking work pretty consistently and starting to actually get a name for myself and prove that I was reliable and consistent, all those other things.
Brilliant.
Wow. Yeah. Just out of curiosity, I know that Hallmark movies tend to have a certain feel to them. What kind of stunt work did you have to do in that?
Well, it was interesting because the story that they were telling, the production itself was, the movie itself was ended up being called Firelight. And it was about a group of women prisoners who were trained in like fire and rescue, EMT work, and that sort of thing.
I ended up being very curious about this Firelight movie and looked into it a little. It starred Cuba Gooding Jr., someone I was pretty familiar with thanks to Jerry Maguire and What Dreams May Come, among other movies. It happened to win an NAACP award, but other than that was rated a 6.7 out of 10 on IMDb. It doesn't even have a Rotten Tomatoes score, which may or may not be good. But in particular, it felt very topical due to the ongoing injustice of prisoners being used as forced labor, as well as the problems with wildfires in the last few years.
I have to pay $8 to see it on Prime, but it's tempting to shell it out and find out what it has to say on prison labor and the like.
So, like, this group of women that were still incarcerated but were entrusted with, like, rescuing people. It was kind of a cool story, and there was a scene where one of the girls had to try to rescue someone from going over the side of a cliff in their car. So that was kind of the scene that I was first brought on in. I stood by for a couple of other things here and there, which were very, very simple, you know, stunt scenes of like, the actress has to climb over a fence and then drop down from the fence and like roll out of it. And, you know, I would do things like that. But then the big one was involved a lot of wires and a lot of rigging and holding on to like the side of a car and, you know, pretending like we were falling over the edge of a cliff. And there was, yeah, it was a crazy scene, but that was kind of the big stunt work for them, was the scene of a car going over the side of a ledge and all of the people trying to rescue this person who is stuck in the vehicle.
Mm. And
wow.
It interests me when you mention about how you weren't just doing the big stunt that, you know, if you looked at the sequence of events of that film, you would go, okay, that's the part of the film where we definitely need to get stunt performers in on that. But
definitely
it interests me that there's more to it than just the big showstopper moment. There's also the smaller moments of just individual shots of, this is a more, slightly more involved physically action that we want the character to do, so let's get someone to do that shot. Would you say that there's quite a wide range where it's not always the big showstopper? There's actually quite a few things where maybe for insurance or anything to do with that, it's just, okay, we need this character to get up onto the horse, and even though in the story that's quite a small scale action, we still need to get someone to do that that isn't the person who, if they get a foot injury, all production stops. Is it something like that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So a lot of times, and this is not unusual at all, this is often how it works out, producers and directors will default to the actors. So if they feel comfortable doing something, if they want to be in the fight scene and show their face and be like, no, I want this for my reel, or I want to show that I can do a little bit of my own action, and they're comfortable with it and they're properly trained, they know how to do it safely, they're fine with the actor doing it themselves. They may still have a stunt double on standby in case something goes weird, or they need someone to set up a shot. They want to do some wide shots where it doesn't matter if you can see their face or not, that sort of thing. But a lot of times it will come down to what the actor is trained for, what they're comfortable with, and sometimes it comes down to whether or not they're actually there that day. you know, sometimes you have multiple units, multiple sets running at once. The actor could be doing an acting scene on one side of things or on the main unit, and then you could be on the second unit with the stunt coordinator doing all of their action stuff. The one that's riding the horse, the one that's driving the vehicle, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So yes, a lot of times it will turn out to be something like that. And I know I've mentioned this also, the last job that I had before everything shut down because of COVID was one of the last episodes of season 2 of Doom Patrol. It was all water work. We were in just a tank of 15 feet of water for 3 days. And there are shots where I can even look at them and I'm like, oh, that's my hand. Like, they lined me up just to put my hand in the shot so that the actress, Diane, didn't have to go down to 15 feet of water all the time because, you know, her ears were starting to hurt, or she just was tired of being in the water. She was, you know, starting to feel like, all right, I need a break from this. So they would ask me to go in and go down to 15 feet and put my hand in the camera just so they had that shot. And so she didn't have to do it herself. So even things that sound very simple, but for, you know, for an actress that hasn't done a lot of water work before and is relatively new to her, and she's been doing it for 12 hours already that day and is exhausted and logged down with water and is just kind of like, I need a chance to step back and take a break, that becomes very important.
At a certain point, I imagine the fingers get pruny. You want to have consistency to the shots.
Yeah, that too.
All right. So at what point, I'm probably going to get this wrong because it was a long time ago, and obviously every time you get brought up, Alex likes to make the Hollywood joke. Was your first episode of School of Movies the BoJack Horseman show? And at what point did you first make contact with Alex and become someone that he would regularly bring onto the show?
Yes, I was first brought on for the BoJack Horseman shows. And I believe at that point, it was just like season one and season two that we did. And that was with Kairu and Debbie, who are also some familiar voices from the podcast. So I first heard of the School of Movies podcast. I think it was still Digital Drift at that time. Alex had done an interview with Andrew Jupin from We Hate Movies. And I had been listening to We Hate Movies for years at that point. I'd been listening since the very, very early days of them. So I actually knew about them before I knew about Alex and Sharon or any of that stuff. So they had posted Alex's interview somewhere. And when I heard it, I was like, I'm going to check out this Digital Drift, Digital Gonzo. I'll see what it's all about. Heard a few episodes. And I was like, I love what Alex is doing. I love what Alex and Sharon are doing. I think they have this amazing analysis. I remember it was like mid-2015. I had just gone to see Mad Max Fury Road for like the third time. And
like you
I saw that movie in theater a lot. And I listened to their show on it, and I found, you know, I was just with a friend at the time, and we had just come back from it, and we're kind of still like, oh my God, like this part and this part. And then I noticed when Immortan Joe did this and they did that, and like everything that we were talking about, Alex and Sharon would immediately say like the same thing. Like we were just kind of on a similar wavelength. It was so bizarre. Cause I was like, everything they're saying, like we just talked about, because we're noticing the same things. I definitely knew that this was something I wanted to become a little bit more involved with. So I friended Alex and I think Sharon too on Twitter. And for a while, I've just kind of interacted with them on Twitter. And then I think most likely when Alex found out what I did for a living, he was like, oh, that's really cool. We should talk sometime. So that's kind of how I made contact with them first, was through Twitter and through the fan community. I knew that BoJack was coming up. I loved the show. I thought it was absolutely amazing. It just blew me away when it first came out. And I really wanted to be a part of it. And I asked him if he was okay with a, you know, basically just a fan of his show coming on to talk about it. And he was very gracious and very generous and said, yes, we would love to have your input, as especially from somebody that is so deeply entrenched in the industry, because I really was. I related to that show in a very personal way because I had been through so much of the similar things that multiple characters had gone through on that show. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my first entry point into that. And from there, it was like, I just stayed in touch with them. And whenever they asked me if I wanted to come on again, I always jumped on the chance to do it. And I felt a little bit more comfortable also approaching Alex as just a person and not the person that made this show that I was such a huge fan of. Like I started thinking of him as somebody that I could actually reach out to and talk to in just a regular way. And you know, I don't know if that makes us friends or not, but it certainly, I think, makes us, you know, colleagues almost in a way, especially since I've collaborated with them in other ways.
Yeah,
I can guarantee that as Alex is listening to this, he is saying to the recording, of course we're friends.
I would hope so, but I have weird issues about those lines and like, they cry. But, you know, for people that I have never actually met in person, unfortunately, it's like, I guess we are friends. Yeah.
I definitely get that. And Greg has become probably one of the people I reach out to and talk to more than most other people, especially in the year of our Lord 2020.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he is essentially one of my closest friends. Greg, it's going to be a while till we actually meet in person, I think.
At this point, it might be a while. But I hope that you guys do. I mean, one of the things that was so sad about this year was that Alex, Sharon, and Lyra were supposed to make a vacation to Florida back in July, a couple of months ago. And we were going to meet up with Victoria. We were going to meet up with Kyra and Debbie, and everybody was going to like meet each other. And at that point, I had already kind of caught up with Kyra and Debbie when I was in Florida last year. So I have met them in person, and I would consider them good friends now. But, you know, to meet everybody else in person, and, you know, that just would have been so cool. And it all just got flushed down the toilet. It was so sad.
It's not super on topic with the podcast, but just briefly, as someone who only had online friends for extended periods, I don't consider friendships to be defined whether you see them in person or not. I have been closer with some folks that I have not met in person till years after making friends with them online, than folks that I have played tabletop RPGs with every week for years. Meeting in person allows for getting to know someone in different ways, and meeting online can make miscommunication more fraught. But that doesn't make it less real. Far more complicated is the relationship between two people that first got to know each other not in a social setting, but when one begins as a fan of the created work of another. One of these days, I'm just going to pull the trigger on having an episode talking only about this subject. Toby and I have already talked it around a bit. But one of the biggest issues is how you separate out the created work from the creator. Because the way you feel about these things aren't the same, and no one illustrates that more than a certain Wizard World author. I'm going to leave it there for now, because if I start talking about this, it's going to drag me down a rabbit hole, and I don't have time for that. But since Toby and I are co-creators, these issues don't apply. The relationship is one of equals. Through the Wind Door is a dialogue, and our relationship as friends is a part of that. If we had not developed a rapport from our first interview with the Shaws, this podcast would not exist.
I will say, Toby, that I would love to come visit you at some point. Obviously, there's no way of knowing when that's going to be possible to do so. I'm not the kind of person that goes on vacations to begin with. I find it difficult to sort of leave the safety of my own personal network and my own home and stuff like that. I'm not a shut-in, but if I'm ever going to go somewhere, I tend to need personal, like someone to help me figure out what I'm going to do and keep myself on track. Otherwise, it's way too easy to get into my own head. But yeah, I would love the opportunity to make contact. I appreciate you saying that.
And vice versa. I'm always on the lookout for if there are conferences happening abroad. I'll go, I wonder if that one is near where Greg is. So we'll see how that works out.
Well, if you...
Friend squad!
Yes! Sorry, the two of us did a private conversation where we were discussing She-Ra and the end of it. Mm-hmm. One of these days I may actually put that out for other people to hear. It's complicated because part of it was the two of us having not a disagreement or a conflict or anything like that, but I needed to air some of my feelings about the show and about how it ended in general. And I don't know. I'll have to go back and listen to it and see if it's something that would even work as
would a listen. Well,
yeah, that's the word. One of these days, I'm probably just going to get Loretta on voice chat so we can talk about Steven Universe because she's a huge fan of that. we're getting farther and farther afield here.
Yeah. So you have over 50 credits to your name on the small and big screen, but you clearly have further talents as your ability to disappear into a role are clear from your work as Catherine and Merlaine, not to mention you managed to pull off some unexpected voices during School of Movies. Mm. Are you ready and interested for more should those opportunities come available?
Yeah, absolutely. I love doing voice work. And actually, my fiance is a professional voice actor as well and a professional stuntman. So it's weird that we have such similar interests and such similar like talents when it comes to that. Although I would say he's much more talented in different ways of stunt work than I am. I'm more like a water aerial work person, and he's more of like a tumbler fighter and that sort of thing. He's very physical and very acrobatic. We've both kind of just grown up doing voices, you know, pretty much from a young age. And it was for no other purpose than to try and make the people around us laugh, just to, you know, entertain the people that were around us. So he's done quite a bit of professional voice work. I've been on the podcast several times. I've done some voice training in the past. So yes, absolutely. If someone were to approach me to do some voice work, I would absolutely take them up on it. I love doing it. In fact, there was a friend of ours who's also in the stunt industry wanted to put together this was early when COVID was a thing. So we didn't realize how relevant it would become. He wanted to shoot a spec commercial for Lysol, for like the Lysol cleaning wipes, which nowadays are like almost impossible to find. I feel like they're more precious than gold now. Like you just cannot get them anywhere. But he happened to have some.
You got any wet wipes on you?
Exactly. Exactly. It's ridiculous how the things that have become scarce and what they are. But he asked my fiance, Bobby, to step in and do some of the acting work for it. He tried doing the voice work for, you know, the voiceover of the commercial. I was like, it doesn't actually sound right. And so he came to me and was like, hey, sweetie, do you want to take a stab at this? And I was like, okay, sure. I can put on a very ad-friendly mom voice. And it felt so weird to do it. Like, I always have a hard time going into like, I am going to try and sell you a product now, but here's what I'm going to do. And I'm a mom trying to sell this thing to other moms. But it's like...
Okay, it's, Karen.
It's just one of those things where, like, you have to think about how the, like, there's a certain tone that you can put to something like an advert or a commercial and what people expect to hear on the actual ad, and to kind of tap into that. It's like a weird balance, but it really is a matter of what do all the other ads sound like? You have to kind of find something that meets that criteria, but still kind of make it your own. So it ended up working out pretty well. And I was actually very, very happy with how it turned out. And our friend's wife was like, oh my God, I didn't even realize that that was her. Like, I had no idea that she did that voice. That's amazing. Like, she thought it was almost unrecognizable. I listened to it and I can definitely hear myself, but because, you know, it's just putting on the ad voice, the radio voice, so to speak, you know, to somebody who doesn't hear me all the time, it doesn't sound like me. So that was kind of an interesting little challenge. And that was actually right before Alex approached me to do more of the voice work for Uncivil Outlaw, for both Catherine and for Merlaine. So yes, I absolutely love doing voice acting. And if opportunities come up to do more, I would definitely jump on it.
Making a note here, ask Maya about voicing fake sponsored ads for Through the Window. I don't necessarily want to get too personal, but I think you mentioned before that is it your fiance or your husband?
Mm-hmm. We're not officially married yet, but we pretty much like, we go back and forth between saying fiance, husband, wife, because we, for all intents and purposes, we are married, but it's just not officially on the books.
Fair enough. Did the two of you meet while performing stunts in the same movie? And yes. Was it one of those weird moments where it's like you punch him, he punches you, and all of a sudden something just clicks?
No. Okay. Yeah, so I don't mind getting personal. This is kind of a funny story, so I don't mind telling it. The first time we met was actually on the set of The Avengers. Believe it or not.
That's a great story. Keep going.
Okay. So I was playing one of the Doctor Strange sorcerers, and Bobby was one of the Ravagers from Guardians of the Galaxy. So we were both booked to be in that big scene at the end of Endgame where everybody comes through the portals and, you know, everybody kind of comes out and it's like this big, huge team up of like all the people. Bobby was almost unrecognizable because he had so many facial prosthetics. It was basically a full face mask. And like, I had briefly met him before, I think at like a meet and greet for some coordinator or other, like kind of shook his hand. Oh, hey, nice to meet you. And then didn't see him again until the Avengers. And he walks up to me and he was like, "Hey, Maya, how's it going?" And I just looked at him and I was like, who is in there? Like, I didn't even, I could not even tell who it was until he started talking. I was like, oh my God, I didn't even realize it was you in there. Like, hello, how are you? It's been months since I last saw you and now I can't even see your face. But, and then after that, we didn't really have much contact with each other until we both got booked to work on the movie Jungle Cruise, which is based, is another one of those Disney movie based off of The Ride, a la Pirates of the Caribbean. At this point, it's anybody's guess when this friggin' movie is going to come out, because they, God, they brought it back for so many reshoots, and it's just been in like post-production, I think, for like 2 years. God. And I have no idea when it's going to be released. So I would say be on the lookout for that new Rock movie of Jungle Cruise, but who knows if it's ever going to get released, and maybe it'll just go straight to Disney Plus and we never know anything anymore.
Release date question mark?
Exactly. But we were both booked to work on that movie, and that's when we really kind of reconnected with each other, and we started talking about music and movies and comedy and all kinds of stuff. And we kind of, we just kind of bonded over these very, very long night shoots that we were on Jungle Cruise. So that's kind of where we really solidified our information. We traded numbers. We got together a couple of times, started dating. And that was kind of where we started.
You just got a wide variety of credits here. Like things that obviously I've heard of and then things that I'd never heard of. And it's just sort of amazing to go through the entire list here. But let's actually start talking. We could potentially talk for hours and hours about your experience in the industry.
That's very true.
But it's technically, as much as I would love to do so, that's not technically the remit of this podcast. And who knows, maybe I want to leave something for Alex.
Oh shit, that's right. We're a New Century podcast. I forgot.
What? Really?
So originally Sharon played the role of Catherine Holloway during the Secret Rooms audio drama. And we talked in detail about how that story evolved from its original published date, and then chapters meant for Steamheart got transposed and moved to the definitive edition. When and where did you come into this process when Alex chose to recast the role?
So Alex approached me to read for Catherine, I think early 2018. So it was about 2 years ago. And I'm not sure what convinced him to approach me to do it, because obviously this was going to be not the easiest thing to do. He's obviously very, you know, emotionally invested with this character, not only because of who she is and because it's his creation, but also because his wife was voicing her originally. But I think he even said this to me, was that he came to a point where he realized that because Sharon was voicing both Abigail and Catherine, there wasn't really a good way to have them in scenes with each other and differentiate the voices enough. So, which is totally understandable. You know, it's really hard if you're playing two characters going off of each other to really make them sound distinguished, especially when they have a similar way of talking, they have a similar accent. It's very, very difficult. So I don't know what made him first think of me to do it, but he asked me if I would read some of them. And I was like, I'll give it a shot. I have not done much of a Southern accent before, but I'll see what I can do. I ended up listening to a lot of West Virginian accents, like people doing the voice tests where they'll read certain words. And I kind of got the inflections and the accent from listening to people who are from West Virginia actually say things. So that was kind of where I came upon the accent. She ended up a little bit more on the side of Clarice Starling than I had intended, but it kind of worked because Clarice Starling is from West Virginia. So that was kind of another touch point for me as well, is like, just think of Agent Starling, and she's from West Virginia, and she never quite was able to shed that accent. So
that's an amazing little tidbit here. I've only seen the movie a couple of times, but I've always had a fondness for Clarice Starling, not just because it was Jodie Foster playing the role, and I've not a crush exactly, but I've always been an admirer of Jodie Foster ever since I got to see her play the tomboy lead role in the Disney movie Candle Shoe, which is a very formative that was a very formative movie for me when I was young. There was that one line from Silence of the Lambs that always sort of stuck with me, particularly as I was learning more about how to be a better feminist, I guess you could say, which is her conversation with her boss. And she's saying that the other cops all look to him how to react and respond to things. And she simply says, it all matters. And that moment just sort of stuck with me. So finding out that she was a touchstone. Yeah, that's one of my favorite words. So Toby knew exactly what I was going to say.
Nice.
We finish each other's sandwiches. It's all good.
I wanted that sandwich.
Tough. It's mine now.
How much did you revisit Sharon's performance as Catherine while preparing? Was your intention to preserve and or recapture some elements of Sharon's version of the character, or were you more about establishing your own take on the role?
I listened to Sharon's version quite a bit, actually, not just to kind of, it made me more familiar with it to hear it a few times, but also it helped with some of the inflection. It helped with, you know, she obviously got direction from Alex first. So to hear, you know, some of the things that she would have had to, you know, some of the emotional beats, some of the things that Alex would have directed her to do, I tried to preserve as far as this is a moment to be very excited. This is a moment to be very quiet. This is a moment to be very empathetic or emotional, or, you know, you can have a little bit more of that intensity. So I took a little bit of that, but I really did want to make Catherine my own, especially because the whole reason I was brought on to voice her was to make her more distinct from Abigail. I definitely wanted to find a way to make her my own. And I was reasonably happy with some of the early work that I did when, you know, re-recording the voice work for the definitive edition. I'd say I'm a little bit happier with how some of the Uncivil Outlaws audio sounds these days, but her recount of the events at Weirwood is one of the most difficult things and one of the things I'm most proud of from any of the audiobooks, from any of the voices I've done.
When you were recording that, because it is one continuous account from you and your character, how many times did you find yourself having to break things apart? Would you sit down and start reading the beginning of the account, and then as you got more and more into it, you found, well, I'm actually just getting through it? Or did you have to break it up into component parts and do, okay, I'm going to do this part of it and then move on to the other? And so how did it work with that?
So I read it through several times on my own, and already, you know, it's just, I mean, a lot of this stuff, and I say this to Alex all the time, is not trying to flatter him. It's not trying to, you know, it's not meant as, you know, trying to butter him up or anything like that. But the writing is good. And if the writing is that good, you can read through this and put yourself in that situation and start to actually feel what this character is feeling. So I knew already that it was going to be hard to get through. The end of that story is fucking heartbreaking. There's just no way around it. And I would read through it and try to say it and like, man, I have to make this at least intelligible for the audiobook. Like, I can't have it break too much, but I want it to be there because it's such a powerful part of the story. And it's such a, I don't know, it's such a beautiful moment. And I really want to save that. It was tough. It was one of those things where when I knew the recording was coming up, I was like, man, I'm a little intimidated by this. I'm not going to lie. I'm like, oof, this is going to be very, very hard. It's going to be an emotional toll. It really is. So when we went to actually record it, I recorded it live with Alex. So it wasn't one of those things where I sat down and just did the file and sent it off to him. He was there to kind of direct me through it. If I'm remembering correctly, we tried to do it as much in one solid take as we could. obviously there were parts where he's like, okay, go back and do that one more time. And, you know, this one was not as clear, so let's try to get a more clear version of that line or what have you. You know, he was there to kind of direct an audio engineer while I was reading it. The last few paragraphs, I think, Alex, like, didn't stop me at all. He just let me go. And once I was at the end, I was like, how is that? And it was like, we were just, oh God, we were just a mess. Like, Alex was crying, I was crying, everybody was crying. Like, and I was like, do you need another one? He's like, no, I don't, no, I don't want you to have to do it again. Like, that was fine. We've got it. I don't want you to have to read it again. I was like, okay, good. So yeah, definitely took an emotional toll for sure.
This is not a question. This is just, unlike Toby, who has been a fan of New Century longer than I have, and so therefore first experienced Catherine Holloway through Sharon's performance, you were my first Catherine Holloway, and that experience, it kind of makes me break a little bit just to think about it. That's how affecting it was. So this is just me hearing you relate the story of that. That does not surprised me at all. That was an extremely effective, amazing, heartrending performance.
Well, thank you. Like I said, it was very difficult to get through it because, again, the writing is so good, but it's a very visual story. So even times where I was like describing what was going on in the house and how gunshots were being fired, people were you know stuff just going on. When I read these things, I'm a very visual person. So I'm imagining all of these events playing out in my head as they're happening. And I'm already a pretty empathetic person. So to be there in that moment and think like, this is somebody that I care about a lot, even though he drives me absolutely fucking spare. I love him. And he's the person that I have devoted myself to. So to see him just calmly sitting underneath a tree and like he's just gone, like picturing all of that in my head was just so difficult, but that's really what it took to get there emotionally.
I found my darling Preston propped up as though in sleep by the side of the cherry tree. It was a place where once sat in our former life, dreaming of the days when things would be still more bright and rosy. Beside him were three men, cut through the heart and neck. Three men, including their arrogant leader himself, who lost a final battle to a crippled soldier with more bravery than they could ever comprehend.
In a moment that really captures everything that the character loves about that man. And just, I will add on top of Greg that, yes, Sharon was my first Catherine, but I rest assured that when I got back to it, even though I knew it was coming, it fucking broke me all over again.
Yeah, so, it's hard not to it's hard not to have that get to you.
Moving slightly to one side, just
slightly lighter topic.
Exactly. One of the things that we've gotten to learn from some of the other voice actors is stories that they have in their own head about their beloved characters that didn't necessarily make it onto the screen. Do you have any unwritten headcanon for Catherine?
I'm not sure if I would necessarily say headcanon, but there was something you guys had mentioned, and I think I even talked to you guys about it on the Discord at one point, the speech that she gives the new kind of intakes to Weirwood Manor when she's talking about, you know, you were protected, you were the ones who were loved, and that sort of thing. This was kind of, I had a slightly different interpretation of that whole speech and that line specifically, which could, I guess, be construed as having my own headcanon about her. But one of the things that I had thought about very carefully was You know, this woman grew up in the 1800s in the South. This is West Virginia, a Restoration era, Civil War era. She is going to be a deeply, deeply religious person. She is going to be a very proper, devout Christian woman. And to me, when she says to the children, we are the ones, you are the ones that were loved. You are the ones that are loved. To me, that took on a lot of religious connotations. Like, God is the one who is protecting us, ultimately. You guys are, we're blessed to be here. And really, when she says, like, we're the ones that are loved, it's like, we're, it's almost like saying we're God's children. And he is the one, at the end of the day, that's looking out for us and that is protecting us.
Wow.
That's actually a really interesting take on it, because...
Yes, I know, Alex. I used the I word. I'm sorry, but I was vamping there because I needed a moment to figure out what I actually thought about that.
Religion doesn't come up that often.
Specifically for Catherine.
Well, as I recall, the one who it comes up for that talks about it the most would be Tabitha Chorley, because it's a part of her bone collector story. And I think she might also mention it a little bit in Secret Rooms. But it doesn't feel like a significant part of, say, Abigail's life, who was the biggest benefactor of Catherine's tutelage. So it just would be... I'm not a particularly religious person, and obviously I have some of my own opinions in regards to organized religion and institutions in general, but it would be interesting to hear some of Catherine's thoughts in terms of how she feels about her faith in light of having to live with this post-apocalyptic world for 10 years, not to mention everything that she's experienced since then, choosing to set her cap with the RSA and then eventually being picked as the successor to the NIA.
Yeah, I agree. And like, to be honest, I'm not a super religious person either, but in this time and in this place, Catherine would be for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if she doesn't talk about it that much, she would still carry that with her for sure.
If I sounded a little vague or diplomatic there, there's a reason for that. I try very hard not to be biased against Christianity specifically. The simple truth is that I don't actually have a problem with Jesus. As a funnier man than me once said, it's just his followers I can't stand. When I wrote this little editorial, it was originally longer. But then I remembered the words of Craig Ferguson. Does this need to be said? Does this need to be said by me? And does this need to be said by me right now? If you can't answer yes to all of those questions, then maybe silence is the better option. This isn't a normal episode anyway, where I'm specifically deconstructing the narrative. This is Maya's time to shine, and when you get right down to it, what she's saying makes perfect sense in terms of culture, time, and place.
And it comes at an appropriate time when she is providing a speech to the children. The speech is essentially establishing this is the institution that you are fitting into and will provide shelter to you. So that level of implication of a wider, we are the ones who are loved, is you are fitting within this institution we're setting up here at Weirwood, and this is fitting into a broader cosmological plan or something like that.
Yeah, there's a certain comfort in bringing up those things, especially if you know that like your children here are going to be steeped in that as well. They're going to have a similar upbringing where that would be something very familiar to them. And, you know, as much as I am not a huge fan of the church or, you know, the religious institutions, as you mentioned, Greg, but that is a very comforting thing when you're in a situation like that. It can be, that's a very Christian way of looking at it, is that you want to provide the familiar, you want to provide something that's going to come as a comfort, that's going to soothe people, that's going to make them feel like things are somewhat normal still.
The Turner phrase also comes to mind, no atheists in a foxhole. Thus far, Catherine has purely been seen to us as being a leader of people. But you yourself, as related to from your experience, you are a very physical person. Do you think there is a future where Catherine is going to come out from behind the desk and mix it up Nick Fury style?
I hope so. I really do. Like, man, I know if push came to shove, Catherine could absolutely kick major ass. Like, I know that in my heart of hearts, she could whip all kinds of ass if it came down to it.
She's got the time period appropriate equivalent of a rocket launcher stacked beneath the desk. I'm sure of that.
She does come to the door with a shotgun at her side. So, you know.
There's definitely that element that is brought to it that Catherine does kick ass, even if she's not had the chance to show that yet. But I think then when we see and hear the play version of Catherine that we see in the Ember Island Players episode, players at the town in Steamheart, that version of Catherine is a lot more demure, like, well, sir, and she's a strong figure, but she ain't a match for the real thing.
Mm-hmm. I think we all have a certain fondness for, like, obviously the idea of the strong female protagonist. People have gotten away from that a little bit and don't always recognize that there are different ways to read, or rather to write, women that have agency that don't necessarily all have to be Imperator Furiosa.
Yeah, they're not all physically strong.
But we kind of love those characters anyway. I mean, I grew up with Sarah Connor and Ellen Ripley, so, you know...
There's absolutely nothing wrong with throwing a little Ripley in there. Although it is funny that you mentioned Nick Fury. I believe that at least in some of the scenes from Uncivil Outlaw specifically, Alex mentioned Nick Fury as being kind of an inspiration for some of her bigger speeches, for some of her shows of power that she has to kind of act out. It's a little bit more theatrical, a little bit more dramatic than she would probably normally be. But the idea was to come out and be this kind of Nick Fury, head of the Avengers character.
I mean, it feels to me like she's always kind of had an inspirational aspect to her, or even just I think that she's very good with words in general, even if it's just a small moment where she has to cut someone to the quick a little bit. Like that one moment where she's facing off against Abigail as she's wanting to leave. And she just is sort of quietly looking down at this 13-year-old girl and saying, "No, I'm not allowed to murder you." Mm-hmm. That does feel a little bit like a Nick Fury moment there on some level.
Yeah.
Definitely. And, you know, going back to... And I remember from listening to that that section of your episode that you recorded, I was like, oh, yeah, they keep coming back to that line of I'm not allowed to murder you. She recognizes that she's not the ultimate authority. There is a higher authority than her, and she does not have the right to play judge and executioner. Yeah, she sees herself as more of a guide almost, but there's always someone above her. There's always someone above them. I'm not the one who's going to decide whether you live or die.
Yeah.
You know, and like, there's someone much higher than me that is going to determine that, you know?
Maya saying this reminded me of a moment from the show The West Wing. I know it's a bit of a minefield bringing up that show right now, but the scene itself was not political. Not exactly. The White House Communications Director, Toby Ziegler, is talking with his rabbi about the death penalty, and the rabbi says something memorable.
Society has a right to protect itself, but it doesn't have a right to be vengeful. It has a right to punish, but it doesn't have a right to kill.
The line is indicative of the strength of the writing in the show, however you feel about it now. Even though it's a different religion, one can see that mentality potentially being a part of Catherine's makeup.
And in between that, she was entrusted with the care of these kids. It's something she takes very seriously, is your parents trusted me to look after you, so of course I'm not allowed to murder you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, she does see that as a very, she takes that responsibility very seriously. So even though, you know, she's not physically pushing Abigail out the door, that's essentially what it boils down to.
It's that word choice, because she could say, I am not letting you do this, and that would place the absolute power and the decision-making squarely at her feet. But it's not that. It is, I'm someone who helps run this, but it's all to a higher purpose, whether it's to your parents and protecting their children or working through God's will. I'm not going to misuse the position I've been placed in by forces outside of just me. This goes far beyond you. It goes far beyond me.
Absolutely. And on top of that, like you said, she could use a far more confrontational word choice. I think the word choice is definitely what plays into perhaps bringing Abigail to her senses, because the wrong words would cause or potentially incite something in the fiery Abigail, and she is desperately trying to de-escalate the situation.
Yeah, it could end up pushing her farther away, and she is this is as much a warning as you're ever going to get. Like,
The parallel is there between that situation and what Abigail just went through in the chapter or two previous, when she was trying to convince people who were going away to not go out from the established shelter of a known settlement. And the comparisons between the two characters are always there, but the difference is that Abigail doesn't make the right choices when it comes to what to say. She does make some good decisions here and there, but there's definitely some places where she falters, and Catherine, I think, shows a much more deft knowledge and understanding of what to say.
And at the end of the day, Abigail's going to punch. Yeah, she's going to talk with her fists more than anything else. So,
God, that suddenly just brings to mind that one line from we're already talking about Shakespeare, and it's not like Abigail is a villain in any way, but it makes me think of that line from Don John: "If I had a mouth, I would bite." So you brought up the welcoming speech, and thank you for doing so, because apparently in my notes I wrote it as Weirdwood again, and that's apparently
you can't help it, can you?
No, it doesn't show up as being a bad. It doesn't show up as being a mistype, so I don't notice it often until I'm actually reading it out.
Yeah, that's really weird.
Tell me, go lay down.
Take a time out.
Yes, yeah. Catherine.
This is going to go out parallel to or just after we discussed those chapters of Secret Rooms, and I sent you our thoughts on Catherine. We get into talking about Catherine Holloway a lot in that particular episode. Do you have any more thoughts about our characterizations, either agreements or different interpretations, or even straight up, no, she's definitely not like that?
I found myself agreeing with most of what you guys were saying, but just the added, again, I think she has a certain element of herself that she sees as being very religious. She is a very, very godly woman in a lot of ways. So I do think that a lot of that does play into some of the things she says and some of the decisions that she decides to make or decides to not make in some cases. But I did want to kind of return to when you guys talking about, did Catherine fail James and Abigail by separating them? And I just, it was one thing where, you know, getting to that scene where she says, like, listen, you know that from now on, I'm going to have to separate you two. And you can't, like, you can be civil to each other, but you can't really be friends. The way Alex kind of described that scene to me was similar to, like, imagine you're Minerva McGonagall right now, and you have to tell Harry and Ron that they can never speak to each other again because of Hermione. Basically, that's what it comes down to, is that, like, these major iconic characters, they can't be near each other anymore. They have to avoid each other, like actively avoid each other. Like she sees something in them that is so destructive and so toxic that she realizes they just can't work together, or at least not right now. They have to grow up a little bit more before they can go back out into the world as a team.
Yeah, so it's certainly channeling that one scene from the Half-Blood Prince film where she says, "Why is it that whenever something goes wrong, it's always you three?" And it's almost like in an alternate world where she's like, "You know, I really should have done something about this a few years earlier."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really interesting to hear. That was Alex's direction, because it was Minerva McGonagall that specifically was coined by Toby back when we were first discussing if there were any other fictional characters that Catherine brought up for us. So I guess we're on the right track.
Yeah, I thought of that when I heard that episode. I was like, oh yeah, they're kind of on the right track with that one, because I mean specifically because of that bit of direction that I got from Alex. And I mean, not even because of that. She does have that sort of feel to her where you could imagine she's this sort of matronly, you know, very, very wise, but also, you know, when she has to step up and take action, she'll do it.
Once again, I feel sad in retrospect to hearing others talk about their Harry Potter influences. Anytime something from those stories come up, fans will also remember the bigoted choices Rowling made. I don't know if that makes my disconnection from that fictional mythology better or worse. As mentioned before, I didn't know that Minerva McGonagall was played by Maggie Smith, and I have a special love for her, especially since getting to see just her oeuvre of biting wit and emotional range from Downton Abbey. And on top of that, the gloves are off now a little bit in terms of what I can and can't say. We've had some issues with that in the past a little bit, where even though Uncivil Outlaw in its written form had been available to the public for many months, since most people listen to Alex's stuff piece by piece in the audio drama that comes out, there would be things that I wouldn't necessarily want to talk about because it would mean that some of my audience wouldn't be able to listen to it because they didn't know about that particular detail yet. Given what's happened in some of the most recent episodes of Uncivil Outlaw, it's hard to say now that Catherine was entirely wrong in her assertion of the way James and Abigail are around each other and the way that they unfortunately play to each other's weaknesses. I think that when Toby and I were discussing it, and obviously I'll have to re-listen to that episode to remember what I said and whether I need to put in some more thoughts about it, I did. Our frustration was that this was Catherine's assertion, but it didn't necessarily feel like there was enough put in place to... There wasn't enough to replace what they lost by no longer having each other, because James isolated himself and Abigail channeled her fire into the work of being Catherine's second, but she never seemed to learn the same level of self-control. Mm. And that's kind of more what I would have wanted to go for in terms of she may have had good reasons for doing so, particularly considering the sequence of events that directly led up to that situation. But I would have wanted more care put into, if possible, to help them become more well-rounded versions of themselves. But then again, maybe that's just that's a little bit of narrative magic there in terms of this story is supposed to be the proving ground in which that happens for them. So
yeah,
it's not necessarily right to put all that on Catherine. She was juggling a lot of pins at the time.
That's very true. And I think even jumping off of that a little bit, sometimes you... Like, sometimes when you're in a position like that, you train the person and you mold the person for the job that they have to do right now. And it's difficult to kind of prepare them for what comes after. In this case, it's very difficult to say whether or not Catherine would know any of what was going to happen after. Mm. So, you know, a lot of that was still very much up in the air. So it's like, well, I need certain tools for certain jobs in this very moment, and may not have been necessarily thinking forward to what happens to these people afterwards when the tool is no longer exactly right for what needs to happen.
Mm.
Mm.
Toby, we both know that we've been waiting for this moment, so I'm going to let you pull the trigger on it. I'm going to let you ask the question. Pull the trigger doesn't feel like a good metaphor to use anymore these days. Go ahead.
So Alex has lauded you heavily for your voice for Merlin, that he apparently auditioned many voices to take Maureen's place, and that you brought something spectacular to the voices test. Could you tell us what was in your mind and that what you were trying to bring forth in depicting our gender fluid archmage?
Absolutely. So it was definitely a process, because the first thing that Alex wanted me to do was actually something for Panther Soul, where he asked me how well I could do a British accent. And he had me listen to some Pirates of the Caribbean and, you know, some of the accents there, and then just read some lines just in my normal voice, but with the accent, just to see how I could get that first. From the beginning, it started as something for a completely different project, for a completely different set of audiobooks, which we haven't even returned to talking about the Panther Soul stuff as of yet. But he just kind of wanted to see what my baseline was in terms of doing the accent just by itself. So I recorded a few lines for him, sent that off, and then he came back to me and said, you know, just for shits and giggles, would you mind awfully?
Look, we've come all this way. Would you mind awfully?
If you just read, like, just, I'm curious to hear how you might sound doing some of Merlin's lines. And I believe, gosh, he gave me a couple of different, I'm going back to that word again, a couple of different touchstones for the type of voice that he was looking for. And he kept coming back to Helen Mirren as kind of an inspiration to, like, listen to how she talks, listen to some of the stuff that she did as, like, Queen Elizabeth and, you know, all these other things. So I did that, tried to kind of find a bit of her inflection and a bit of her gravitas, I suppose. She's got a very commanding sounding voice. And I was like, all right, let me take a little bit of that. Tried it again. And he was like, it sounds great, but you still sound too young. So now it was a matter of, okay, you've got the accent, you've got kind of the tone that I'm going for, but you don't sound like an old woman. And of course, Merlin is supposed to be elderly at this point. Mm-hmm. So again, it's one of those things where, like, I feel so stupid trying to sound like an old woman at the microphone. Like, oh my God, what am I doing? This seems so ridiculous. So just to, like, get myself out of my own head, I just started riffing kind of based off of something that I'd heard. I think it was a stand-up comedian was just kind of telling this, like, silly story. Like, oh my God, it sounds so funny when, like, older people say certain words. So I was like, all right, I'm going to try it just to kind of loosen myself up, to get myself out of my own head. And Bobby started recording me just riffing this ridiculous story about how I had... I'm going to have to find the audio clip so that you can actually put it in there. But
yes, please. Suffice,
yes, I know we've still got it somewhere. And I sent it to Alex as a joke, because I was like, we just recorded this to try and, like, get the older sounding voice, and we thought it was really funny. So I sent it to him just to be like, hey, you might get a laugh out of this. And he was like, oh my God, that was hilarious. Now, I don't know if that soundbite was specifically what landed me the role ultimately, but it certainly helped me in getting myself to just, like, shake out the butterflies, so to speak, and just do the voice. I kind of put aside, like, you know, forget about trying to sound like Helen Mirren. Just make yourself sound old. Just get a little bit of that shakiness, the little bit of the breaking in the voice. And I actually did it to such a degree that Alex came back and said, you're actually sounding a little too old now. Back it off just a little bit. So it was actually going
too hot,
bit,
too, you know, cold,
too far in that realm. And I just backed off of it a little bit. and funny that we've been talking about Maggie Smith all this time. But in my head, I was like, you know, this voice kind of ended a little bit more on the Maggie Smith side than I originally wanted, but it helped. It certainly helped having her voice kind of like in my head at that point. It's like, this is going to keep me like that image of her, of either as, you know, her character from Downton Abbey or as McGonagall. It helped kind of put me in that place. Like, you're not yourself. You have to be an older person. So having that image in my head helped me get back to that place. And it got to the point where I pretty much didn't have to think about it anymore. Like, I could just go straight into the voice without having to like do all of this extra work to like, to find the old, to find the accent, to find the tone. It just all kind of came together. So that possibly is what Alex heard in the very last bit of audition lines that I sent to him. Was like, cool. All of this stuff finally came together in one person. Great. We're going to move forward.
I don't know if Alex ever planned to do anything with this, but once again, we're going to scoop him. Here, as a Through the Window exclusive, an audition test from Maya Santandrea trying to be an old woman. Brief editor's note, I recorded that intro before actually listening to it. I'm just going to put in a brief warning. This is not safe for work a lot.
All right, well, now, let me see here. Well, it must have been the summer of 1862, I believe. I do remember finger banging, and, let me tell you, I was once finger banged by Abraham Lincoln's nephew. Oh my, quite a tall fellow he was. In fact, when he removed his riding glove, it was like a fistful of dicks.
Our heroine, everybody, Maya Santandrea. We now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. Oh, I was going to say, one of Toby's additions to our question list was wondering if voicing a less physical and older wizard character like Merlaine had been a refreshing change of pace, but it sounds to me like that was almost as taxing and stressful as it is that some of the work that you might do as a stunt performer, finding that happy medium there.
Yeah, it was definitely a process. Like, I think I went back and forth with Alex, a few times, like more than three times. We went back and forth with like, all right, turn this up a little bit and now turn that down a little bit. Now bring this up a little bit, but then dial this back a touch. And there were even some, I'm not tooting my own horn this much, but there are instances where in the finished audiobook, Alex took some of the lines that I used as the audition takes because he liked them so much. He was like, you know what? You did this line so good in the audition takes. I'm actually going to use that. And then would have us move on to, you know, a different line or a different section of the story.
Well, that's a time saver.
That was kind of a cool thing to hear. But at the same time, I worked so hard on trying to find that voice even, you know, it was just one of those things where it's like, I got to get this right. I know I'm up against a lot of competition. He told me how many people were trying to nail that voice. And for myself, a lot of it was, I just want to see if I can do this. I really want to see if I can push myself to actually get this where Alex wants it to be. And if it doesn't end up being exactly what he wants, that's totally fine. Like, I can accept that if somebody else gets the role. But wouldn't it be cool if, you know?
It was more seeing if you could get to that place regardless of whether it would turn up in the final product.
Exactly. Mm. So, and I was very happy with how it worked out, especially because it was such a challenging thing to find and to keep consistent throughout the recording of those actual chapters. I was pretty happy with how it came out, and it was a ton of fun to do. So I was having a blast playing Merlaine. So that was kind of one of those additional bonuses. It was like, this was just super fun to take on.
that is an important thing to do whenever you're doing any kind of work, is to find the spark that brings out the passion in whatever it is you're doing, I imagine. Obviously, Merlaine is one of the most enigmatic characters, and therefore it's hard to talk about them, as their history and motivations are naturally meant to be mysterious. Some things we can't know because of plot. Some things we never may know because wizard. But there
is the
literally. But there is the hint of an implication that, say, like the Time Lord Doctor, that her various forms may have different qualities to them. In your mind, are there differences between your Merlaine and the others as voiced by Maureen and Alex, and what are they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Alex even makes this kind of explicit when there's that scene where James kind of almost hallucinates this like cosmic state where everything sort of like warps in and out, and there's all these sounds and these visuals and music going on.
We've been calling it Centrum for a while now,
said Merlaine breezily, pulling on insulated gloves and retrieving a steaming pie from the oven.
Centrum.
Centrum, I thought, and at this moment reality seemed to melt away, and the vision of Merlaine swam before me, piercing eyes gazing into both of mine, including my left under the patch.
Centrum.
I visualized a cartwheel, a sunflower, a human iris, pupil dilated to take in more and more. The darkness of that black hole grew behind it, and yet within it was a supernova, a concept I hadn't even considered until that point. And for the briefest of moments, within that supernova, something like an octopus of unfathomable scale, so large it devoured both space and time, flung itself up so high above me that my own size became irrelevant. I teetered on the edge of madness as infinity poured into my mind.
We've been calling it Century for a while now,
said Merlaine breezily, pulling on insulated gloves and retrieving a steaming pie from the oven.
Century.
Century, I thought. That sounded grand, important, and worth protecting.
And suddenly, you know, my voice comes in with, we called it Century.
Mm-hmm.
It implies that she's taking aspects of a different time and space, of a different plane of existence, and forming all of that into her own being. So she can almost shapeshift depending on the situation. Like, all right, saying this certain word or saying this certain phrase didn't work for this person, or it made them go mad. That's bad. Mm. I need to back off and try something else and try something again. Like, in my mind, Maureen's version of Merlaine, Alex's version of Merlaine, they're all different. They're all kind of different personalities. But not only that, it's pretty heavily implied, like in the text, that they come from different places. They are literally like parallel versions of themselves.
Mm. Mm. And there is in the scene this sense that she is speaking, or at the very least communicating, through different levels, through different voices, because there will be things that the characters are saying to her that she will respond to, but then there will be moments where James is having some internal narration, just thoughts that he's having to himself, and she will answer that. And so there is, even though those will be things that one voice is responding to both of them, there is this quantum thing going on where there's many voices happening all at once. And I think that that transition just adds to that impression.
And Merlin in general has always been, they've played around with his supposed complicated interaction with time to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
So the idea of, instead of like aging backwards, that she's moving sideways through alternate reality versions of herself is a different and intriguing and entertaining expression of that idea.
Yeah, definitely. It's a fun character. It really is. And it's a really neat way of kind of taking a very famous and very recognizable character and kind of putting your own spin on it.
Mm. And as cosmological and as philosophical as things can get, you have something to ground yourself, which is a talking asshole horse who you can just have an old married couple argument with.
Oh, man. Yeah, that scene is so great. I ended up reading that scene so many times. I could practically do it by memory. And the funny thing was, and again, this is, I think, a testament to Alex's writing as well. When he cut my lines with, is it Spencer that does?
Spencer, yes.
Yeah. So when he cut my lines together with Spencer's, he was like, I can't believe it. It sounds like you're in the same room with each other, just talking to each other. And I was like, well, that's fantastic. But also, it's not just because we nailed the voices so much. It's because the conversation moves so fluidly and it feels like these people have just been together forever and they just bicker and argue like an old married couple. Like that's really in the writing for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Well, we may get the opportunity to actually do some in the same room voice work as a part of some future endeavor. There's nothing been set in stone yet, but so far, Loretta and Matt in particular have already been heavily on board with the idea of the two of us interviewing the characters. So the idea of you and Spencer being on the same Skype conversation and actually able to play off each other in real time, that would be very fun.
Would we be the couples counselors in that situation?
Oh, God. No. I'm pretty sure that we're going to be ourselves. We're not going to be like some weird version of like Penn and Teller.
How does that make you feel?
Also, it wouldn't be Penn and Teller anyway, because then one of us would have to not speak.
Yeah, one of you would have to be it the whole time. I don't know if that would work for a audio-based endeavor.
Exactly.
Well, if one of us is ill that day, then we can use that as a little in-universe bit.
Oh, dear. And I'm sorry, Toby couldn't be with us today. The Windar outside his house got stuck open, and he's currently fending off hordes of Wendigo that want to know when we're finally going to talk about Princess Thieves.
And then I come in at the end, just panting.
Soon!
Sorry about that. Anyway, starting the interview. Wait, where did everybody go?
Where am I, and where did all these Wendigos come from?
It's a problem when you conduct a whole podcast using Windors. You just run into little roadblocks and hazards like that.
Look, just go down to the pub, have a pint. It'll all blow over. Oh wait, you can't
wait
because
for
of
it
COVID.
All to blow over.
All right, back to the interview.
Fine.
So, thus far, you are a member of the cast that has only two major roles to your name, but you have talked multiple times on how proud you are on your voice work for New Century. So, it sounds to me like there is a room for more roles on the table going forward. Do you have any special preference as to the potential kinds of roles that you would like to play?
Not necessarily. I would always love to come back and voice more characters for New Century. And as I mentioned before, Alex had briefly mentioned possibly doing something for Panther Soul. I was shown a rough like rendering of what a character that I may or may not voice might look like. I realize that's a whole lot of vagary, but that's just all the information that I have right now. So whether or not that's actually set to move forward, that depends on Alex's process. And if the character changes it anyway, I certainly wouldn't be offended if he said, you know what, this character is kind of going in a different direction than I originally imagined. So I'm going to bring somebody else to voice them. But, I might be able to do something else later down the line. I always thought it would be really cool to have a really I want to be a badass, like ass kicking woman tiger or something like that. Like that would be great. I think that would be absolutely awesome. I would have a lot of fun doing something like that. But I find more often than not, the more challenging roles and things that I'm not quite as adept at and the things that I'm not quite as familiar with and that are very outside of what I feel my own personality and my own experience have been are a little bit more fun for me because it is such a challenge and it is something that I actively have to work towards. if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely. Dovetailing onto that, your roles have been characters who were entirely fictional, but New Century obviously includes several non-fictional characters as being a part of, you know, like, this is history that is going on. So we've got Annie Oakley, Frederick Douglass. And the way Toby puts it in here, as he refers to Ulysses S. Grant as President Batman. are there any historical figures from this particular period who you think that you would be a good fit for, or that you would specifically be interested in voicing?
None immediately spring to mind, but I would have to think about that a little bit, simply because I'm actually not as well versed in Civil War history as some people are. I mean, nothing really springs to mind, but I really do enjoy doing the, you know, original characters that Alex comes up with. They kind of have their own personalities and you can play around with them a little bit more. Although I'm sure doing something like recently what we've seen with Edison and Tesla, like there's definitely some room for other characterization and to play around with them a little bit more. So I see the appeal to it, but there's nothing that immediately pops out and goes, man, I would really love to voice whoever from this period, like Marie Curie or whatever, something like that. Although Eleanor Roosevelt would be kind of fun if he ever gets that far in history.
I do have someone in mind, and it's a character that Alex has already mentioned.
I think I know who you're going to mention.
Yeah, it's already mentioned as wanting to have brought into the story somehow. How would you feel about swearing up a storm playing Calamity Jane?
Yes. That's a big old yes. That's a part where I would, I would not have to do much acting at all. I swear up and down, left, right, and center all the time anyway. So that wouldn't be much of a stretch.
Excellent. I'm glad that we're on the same wavelength there, Craig.
Yeah,
was thinking,
we're definitely on the same page.
Maybe I should ask about Calamity Jane, and then you immediately ask about it's Calamity Jane. That's perfect.
Are you eating the sandwich?
Nah, you have it, mate.
All right, fine. corned beef. No. Sorry.
Oh, what luck. There's a French fry stuck in my beard. I saw that clip today. It made me laugh.
Funny.
So we're coming up to the end of our list of questions. This has been amazing. And quite frankly, I've just been happy hearing you talk about your work. And the last question on our list is, if you could get to have tea with one or both of your characters, what would you want to talk about?
Really great question. I mean, I think, the obvious answer is Merlaine, and sit down and have tea with her and the Nag and talk about like the universe and the cosmos and magic and all of these other things. Like, I would love to take magic lessons from Merlaine. That would be dope as hell. But, that's kind of the obvious answer. I think, if I'm being a little bit more realistic, I honestly think that having a conversation with Catherine about the people that she's left behind, I think that would actually be a little bit more of a, it'd be slightly less fun because it would get into some heavy stuff. Mm. But Catherine is a character that I see as having, simply because of the position that she's in and the responsibility that she's had to take on, and the fact that there are just monsters running about all over the place, she has had to deal with an incredible amount of loss. That is something that I kind of find, like, I go back to a lot with even, I'll write stuff on my own on the side, just kind of for fun, just for myself. And that's something that I return to a lot as well, is that I'm usually writing through or processing some kind of a loss or some kind of a grief that is either still ongoing or that is just never kind of left me. And I would love to ask Catherine, how she's dealt with that over the years and what are the things that she hasn't been able to necessarily let go of? Is she trying to let go of them? Does she think she can? Does she want to? Does she want to let go of certain aspects of herself that may not be the most pleasant memories or that may cause her grief? Like, how much of that does she see that as being a part of herself and a part of her personality?
One of the things that draws me so much to New Century is its thesis on loss, is that it's one of those universal experiences that connects people, is that at one point or another, you are confronted with it, and it's something that doesn't ever stop. It's an ongoing thing that you deal with, and on some days you're dealing with it better than others. With Catherine, that would be a very revealing conversation, because for so much of New Century, she's not given the opportunity to necessarily talk with someone on equal terms. She is kind of someone who is representative of as a leader of both Weirwood, and then in Uncivil Outlawship, her post goes even higher. So she rarely has the chance to necessarily have a conversation with someone like that. And I think that's why the chapter of Secret Rooms, where she talks with Annie, does hit quite hard, because it's one of the few moments where you do feel that she says, "Call me Catherine," and Annie says, "Call me Annie." And it's a moment where she gets to, even if it's not for very long, have that equalizing moment. And it's because they are both acknowledging the loss that they've gone through and acknowledging what loss they may go through again in the future. And that's the thing that brings people together. I'm not even sure where to go with that, but that's the point.
Yeah, but and you're right. I mean, it is a moment where you kind of get to see these two characters as just normal people, just having that conversation. And it is, I do think it would be a fascinating thing to hear more about. And, you know, this is something I could kind of explore on my own too, as that character, that sort of inner headcanon that you guys mentioned earlier. How did she actually feel about what happened to Lucy? You know, she must have had an emotional response to that, but because of the position that she's in, she can't really focus on it in the way that Alex has written it. It's more focused on Abigail and James's emotional response to it. And Catherine has to be the responsible one. She's got to be the one in charge, where she can't even necessarily process it in that moment. She has to deal with the aftermath of it right then and there. Yeah, I think that would be a really cool thing to explore kind of in the future, is like, how has all of this taken a toll on her? And, you know, did she feel any sort of guilt or any lasting grief from this? You know, this is a pretty traumatic thing. You know, even if you're not best friends with this person, the death of a child is horrible. No matter if it's your child or not, the death of a young person at all is just hell to go through. So these are kind of her children. Like, she must have just suffered greatly from that, and she never really gets to express it.
The most we see is the first action she takes with James isn't to talk about what happens next. They hug. It is a moment where she's providing support to him, but there has to be a certain level of connection there, where she is indulging, if only for a moment, in a shared sense of this was a tragedy, and for a moment will acknowledge that and take that in, and then we're going to talk about what happens next.
Right. You bring up, or rather Toby brought up, her feelings about Lucy. Honestly, listening to you talk about the losses that Catherine has had, the thing that came up to me, something I had actually never considered before, is given how that moment in her office where she makes a connection with Annie Oakley, how much that was a turning point in her life, I feel like the overall implication is that they, two of them, probably never got to see each other again. And then Catherine takes her position at the NIA and has to hear that Annie died while she was on the Steamheart Exposition, which means that all the potential for this connection between two powerful women in leadership roles who have had to make difficult decisions, she would never get a chance to renew that connection. And that just feels enormously tragic to me. And I would therefore be very curious to hear her talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I certainly agree with you that, you know, that is kind of the last they have with each other. And it is kind of a shame. Like, it's a pretty big loss. Even though Catherine wouldn't have known her as well as some of the other characters, she would definitely feel it.
Talking so much about this aspect of Catherine's character specifically, and me talking about how loss is that thing that connects us, it makes my mind turn towards Mulane. And we don't necessarily think of what Mulane's origins are, her background, but there's this wonderful paradox with Mulane and characters like Gandalf, where as these wise wizards that are sort of almost upset apart from the rest of the reality that they have chosen to inhabit, they maybe ought to be disconnected from things, but their earnestness and their kindness and their long life, you see a wisdom there that is born from many years of experience, and you know that loss has been a part of that. And yeah, I think that in the chapters that we see of Mulane in Uncivil Outlaw, there's this sort of time-breaking sense of sad awareness of loss that has been and loss that will be.
For those of you that are sad we didn't explore more about Mulane, it's a difficult subject to broach, in part because the rule is so new to Maya, but also because we only know the barest glimpse of that character and have yet to even begin deconstructing them in our regular episodes. This conversation is about the deepest we get, but I assure you, some of the thoughts that we had about Mulane, specifically due to their characterization in Uncivil Outlaw, are bubbling with possibilities for the future. I'm only sorry it's going to take a while before we can actually start talking about them.
I'm aware this isn't really a question as much as it is a ramble, so I apologize for the full stop that that comes to.
No, I think it's a fair observation. And Mulane, again, yeah, it's one of those things where they just, these wizard characters, it just seems so unfathomably old and wise. You know, how much have they have gone through? They're almost immortal. And how would they, you know, process something like that? But then the parts of Merlane's story from Uncivil Outlaw that I find myself enjoying the most were the times where she would be a little bit more gentle towards the Nag, who she's been with forever. The times where she would tell James something like, you don't want to take this gift that has been given to you. I think it's in exactly the right hands. It's exactly where it needs to be. And, you know, those little moments there, or when she's coaching Abigail and she just has that moment where she says, you know, the price hasn't been paid yet. You know, things like that, that kind of hint to a deeper understanding, but also a deeper emotional connection to what has come before and what's going to happen next.
It's that balance between having a wide enough perspective that you can see that, yes, this is exactly how things are, but not being so far removed that you lack the empathy for the people involved in this, that she can say, look, I know that in the grand game that fate plays, that this is how things are, but I see you, and I acknowledge what this will be like to go through this.
Well, this ending has been particularly heavy, but as has been established in previous interviews, it makes perfect sense that there's the serious answer to that final question, which we have shaped into a couple different forms, and then there is also the joke answer to that question. It's going to be an experience when we finally release Matt Wardle's interview and he gets to share who it is that he would like to most have in a conversation, because I can assure you no one will expect that answer.
Sweet.
To bring it back to a slightly happier place, do you think you can do the voice of Audrey 2 for us? Is that something you can pull out of your pocket? I understand. Oh, man. Maybe you record it somewhere else and then send it to us and I just incorporate it later.
Yes, that can certainly happen. I'll whip something up for you for Audrey 2, and I'll find that little clip of the jokey Merlaine voice that I used in my. It's you'll laugh. It's completely ridiculous and stupid, but it was very.
That's
very
exactly
funny.
My.
So
thing.
You'll get a laugh out of that.
Unfortunately, we didn't move fast enough on the Audrey 2 voice to time it with the release, so maybe that's something for the future. But I do think the test clip more than makes up for that lapse. Brilliant. Maya, I don't, like it is with a lot of these interviews, I don't want to let you go. I do have other things that I have to take care of. And, you know, obviously, as things continue to progress, as you continue to get more characters, we would love to have you back on to discuss other things as they come up. It's been wonderful to have you here today. And I very much look forward to whatever New Century has in store for you, or even hearing more about, you know, when things potentially, hopefully, return to some form of normality, hearing what new thing you're going to be working on in Hollywood.
Yes, well, thank you very much for having me, guys. It's been a lot of fun, and you're doing the Lord's work out here, so bless you both.
Oh, it has been such a pleasure talking with you this evening. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been really...
Is it evening?
it is now, actually, or it's close to it. But yeah, it's been really awesome to kind of like, oh, this is what these guys are like. It's, you know, they're real people out in the real world. They're not just like... Yep. A picture and a line of text on a website somewhere, you know?
Yep. We're not just sentient AI or anything like that. Well, maybe
Thank
we are. You don't
God.
Know.
Wait, no. Oh, no. Okay. Different podcast now.
Look, just don't ask me about a turtle in a desert somewhere, you know?
I will never. I would not.
That's just impolite.
Honestly, one of these days, I'm just going to find potentially like someone I know on Twitter or even a member of the Discord community to just see if they can do an artist rendition of like me, but wearing sort of that half Tony Stark Iron Man helmet on, and then just take that one picture that Toby has where he's saluting in his Captain America shirt. And that those will be our two pictures for the podcast, the way... Diogo Lopez did yeah. James and
Mortimer
for School of Movies.
Yeah. Somebody get on that. Someone get on that right now.
All right. Maya, again, you have a great evening and we'll see you around the Discord.
All right. Thanks so much, guys.
For all of our listeners, we'll see you on another trip through the Windor. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And for our outro, I found myself at a little bit of a loss at first. None of my usual favorite musical artists that I hadn't already used were specifically resonating as a choice to close out our little interview. At first I started looking at someone I hadn't revisited in a long time, Sarah Borges and the Broken Singles. This is a group you very likely would not have heard of, as they are a local Boston indie band that do a little bit of musical fusion, rock and roll that combines elements of punk and country. The piece I was originally looking at was called Better at the End of the Day, which had a definite country feel to it. I didn't have a specific love for this song, and really only knew about the band because they were a favorite of a friend, who got me a CD of theirs. After further consideration, I decided I needed something less downbeat to end on, especially given current events. So drawing on the energy that Maya provided during her sample piece, I went in a different direction. Maya grew up in Massachusetts, and I have been a masshole all my life, so this one feels somewhat appropriate, especially given where she moved to in order to get into Hollywood. This song is actually a visual performance, so I'll include a link in the doobly-doo, but it works just as well as a song, and the energy is gloriously camp and not safe for work. Performed by the Adam Ezra Group, here's a variation on an old classic. Instead of going down to Georgia, here's what happens when the devil came up to Boston.
The devil came up to Boston, he was looking for some balls to break. He just got in from Quincy where he'd rained out a lobster bake. At the Copley Tea, he saw a kid son on a fiddle and smoking a butt. The devil jumped up on a globe dispenser, said, dude, let me tell you what. I bet you didn't know it, kid, but I can fucking strum. You may think you're all hot shit, but you're just a fucking bum. I've rocked all the hot spots from the garden to the wang. I'll bet a lotto card and a pack of mobs that you can't fucking hang. The kid said, my name's Sully, and you're a stupid fuck. But if you want a party, I'm game to enter back. Sully, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard. Shit's going down in Boston and the devil deals the cards. And you could win a lotto card and pack a Marlboros. But if you lose, the devil gets your soul. The devil opened up his case and said, I'll fucking start. Fire shot from his fingertips. Damn, that shit was hot. The screech across the strings, it got the subway cops all pissed. Then the Dropkick Murphys showed up and it sounded something like this.
Fuck you, Donnie!
Fuck you!
I told you before, I'm not going out there wearing this shit.
Said good job, but I hear that shit like every hour. I'm gonna rip it up now, then you could take a fucking shower.
Oil in the harbor, watch out, sailor. Bringing in steamers and a Boston whaler. Cocked in Mattapan, stealing a truck. Y'all bringing Southie, what the fuck?
Cause he knew he'd just been tossed. He started chugging vodka to soften up the loss. Sully shouted, devil, come on back if you ever want to press your luck. I told you once, you're hot on, you're a wicked, stupid fuck.
The thing that I was thinking of was actually Mortal Kombat, where he recorded everybody saying Mortal Kombat and then playing them on top of each other.
And we had to do it twice because, it didn't, because it wasn't recording the first time. So we each had to do the Mortal Kombat thing twice around, and then he got it and then just played them all at the same time, which was very funny. But but it was like, oh no, you didn't record. Crap.
Let me see here.
Either one of us starts coming up with individual interview questions or talking points for episodes beforehand, then the other one looks at that and then makes suggestions or adds or everything like that. Mm-hmm. And then that tends to be what we go with.
Yeah.
You're giving away all our trade secrets, Greg.
Oh, well, goodness. I didn't realize this was a brand we had to worry about people imitating.
Maybe
Enter
not.
The Wind so. Door is creeping up on us, I tell you. That rival fan podcast.
Oh, God.
Let me see here.
And we can edit it so that the Audrey 2 thing just sort of seems to happen completely off the cuff. And we go, oh, my God, you've still got it. Just, wow, you did that right off the cuff.
If we add the music to the background as well, it'll be like all of a sudden we stop to have a musical number.
Brilliant.
Let me see here.
I guess we have one last question, which was to do with the White Scarvengers.
Well, so this is... We had this conversation a long time ago where it's like, when back when we were originally like, okay, so we're trying to think of characters that specifically showed up in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. As you are well aware now, we have gotten completely far afield.
Yeah, we went off the rails fast.
we have a DC wizard, Zatanna. We have Bat Pie, a combination of Batman and Pinkie Pie. And Matt,
yes.
Matt ended up picking out one of the planeswalkers from Magic: The Gathering, Ajani, who is a tiger based spellcaster.
Oh gosh! Wow.
Back when we were originally talking about this, we were going along the lines that because you're playing the character that is the new head of the NIA, that you would be Maria Hill. Do you want to stick with that, or would you want to go farther afield and pick out someone not from the MCU as your personal representative?
I mean, again, with Catherine, I feel like the obvious answer is Nick Fury, but if he's already claimed, then I think...
Alex is definitely Nick Fury, but okay. Yeah.
Well, then I would certainly be comfortable with Maria Hill being that point of reference.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
We need to find more.
More weapons.
More heroes.
You think you can find others like her?
We found her and we weren't even looking.